This is tape number three, side one of the ongoing oral history interview with Professor Doug Price. This is May 2nd, 2007. Doug, I'd like to pick up the interview today with a focus on the department and begin with, you've talked some about the department, but if you would make some observations about the department when it came here, how it has changed globally over the years, significant hires, and where the department is today.
Okay, that's a big question. When I came here, I didn't know much about it. It was my first job, and I really wasn't very aware of the reputations of departments. I knew about the two or three, four best ones around, but I didn't know anything about Wisconsin, and I inquired a little bit before I was employed and offered the job and found out where the power lay in the department and so forth. I think I was here 5 or 6 years before I really started to get a sense of what was going on in the department and how it operated. And I was the first hire in probably 8 years at that time in 1974, and no one else was hired for another 5 or 6 years when Amoco Inuki Tierney was hired. So I was in a big gap in there, and I was the youngest member of the department by a long shot. That's why I'm now the senior member of the department, but not the oldest. I always point that out. Jim Stoltman, for example, referred to me as the baby professor for about 10 years.
Really?
So people were very nice, and it was a pleasant place to be for the most part. I mean, there are a couple of strange folks around, but that's average. And gradually I started to realize that the average age in the department was pretty high, and things moved pretty slowly and were pretty much behind sort of what I thought anthropology and productivity and computers and so forth should be. But that took probably six, 8 years. And started thinking we really needed to make some changes in the department, but it was hard to do because a lot of people were getting close to retirement or not so interested. But everybody was around all the time, and there was a sense of collegiality, and it was a nice place. I think the department, you know, is probably in the top 20 in the country, and probably around 20, is my guess. And I used to want to make the department a lot better place in terms of its national reputation, because I want it to be at a top scale place. And there's something like 76 departments, PhD departments in the country, maybe 80 now. So that gives you maybe a sense of where we were. In terms of important hires, I mean, Amoco was an important hire because she was very well regarded when she was hired, and up the level of productivity and reputation in the department. There were several people that we hired in that period who have been less than stellar, perhaps, later on. But I think we only hired one or two people before I became chair, before I was elected chair.
Really?
I think so. I can't remember for sure, but the department stayed about the same size. That was one of the issues I had, that we were still about 17 people in the department, which I thought was very small. Mm-hmm. I'd come from Michigan, which had, I don't know, 40 or something like that. And I just thought we could never really make a big splash in the rankings unless we had more people. So I was elected chair. Are we ready to go there?
Sure. Yeah, and that was when?
84, I think. That sounds about right, because I came in 74, and I got tenure in 80, and I was elected chair 84, 85. Right?
Did you want to be chair?
Yeah, I did.
So
I
you did. Campaigned for it?
I'm sure I told people that I wanted to be chair, because otherwise they wouldn't know. But at that point, we didn't have a lot of politics and campaign. I'm not even sure if anybody else wanted to do it. I'm not sure there was any opposition. I don't remember that.
Uh-huh. Anyway,
it was sort of consensus then, the way things generally worked. And so I set about trying to grow the department, trying to get the department up to date in terms of how things worked and how we did things in the department office and staff. And it was a pretty good period because university was adding some people that time. So
you got money for new positions?
I think I added 6 positions to the department at that time. It was as big as it's ever been, unless it's right now. And I had a good relationship with Dean Cronin, I think. He helped. He seemed to like what we were doing and wanted to see Anthro go some. And so now, I think that went well.
That's interesting. How did you develop a good relationship with the dean? Had you known him?
No, I never met him before, and I always thought he was really scary when I first started going over there to talk to him. But I don't know, I guess over the years, over 5 years, I started to really have a sense of what he was doing and to respect that. And we got, I think we were pretty friendly toward the end. And I think, you know, we sort of shared the same goals for anthropology. I think we may have talked about that once, I don't remember.
And what were your goals? You said you wanted to grow the department.
Get bigger, try and get people to be more productive. We had a number of people who weren't doing anything. To get the office better, to get us up to date in terms of getting some computers in for everybody, which we did. Getting all the videos or the thing, whatever we have, the films. We had films then, right? Getting all that stuff updated to VCR and technologies that we could use. We changed completely from when we had that film library down on University mm-hmm. Avenue. That always, it was such a pain in the butt to having our own videos and now our own DVD library, which lets us gives us a lot of flexibility in terms of stuff like that. And changing rooms around and doing a lot of things. And the department, I think it's fair to say at the beginning of that time, was happy to see some changes going on and to see something happen. Generally, people, you know, thought it was good. I think what happened, well, I know what happened over time, is that I became a little bit too decisive, and I bullied people into doing things that I wanted, and that was resented by some.
Now, when you say that, that you bullied people, these your decisiveness, however, was in service to a good end, I take
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I thought so.
Uh-huh. Now, Jim Stoltman said that you do not suffer fools gladly.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, and that can be a problem.
When you're chair, is that taking the best of your intellect and energy? Are you having to set aside research and teaching? Or are you just picking up the chairmanship and continuing with the rest of your work?
I think I pretty much continued with the rest of my work. It was nice to get the release, the teaching release. You get a half-time teaching release for chair. So that I always thought that almost made up the amount of time that I spent teaching those 2 courses, that it was more or less equivalent. I mean, I worked for long hours anyway, and I really enjoyed being chair a lot until the very end.
And that was because you could create?
I think it was because I could shape the department the way I wanted to go. I could make things happen.
Uh-huh.
I was very proud of growing the department that much. That was a significant change. And it was sort of getting the department where I thought it should be, I guess. But I think I started out, since nobody seemed to be very caring very much about where we were going, that I sort of just did it. I just took over and did it. And by the end, when I knew all the ropes and knew what I was doing, I did things when I should have got consensus and got agreement, and I didn't do that.
When you were talking yesterday about trying to create an Institute of Archaeology, mm. did that happen while you were chair?
No, that must have been a couple years after.
After, okay. So when you say that you didn't consult and you were doing things, this was still focused on the department.
Right, right.
Per se. Were you actually able to hire some additional archaeologists during this time
period? We moved the archaeology section from 4 people to 6. We moved the biological section from 3 to 4, and we moved the cultural section from, added a couple there, I think, maybe 3.
Now, I have to assume that the department was happy with what you were doing, because you told me off tape that you were chair for 5 years,
right,
when the
right.
usual tenure was 3.
Right, yep.
So I take it they simply, at the end of your formal term, they ask you to continue.
Yeah, or I just, you know, was willing to do it. Mm-hmm. And nobody else was, I don't remember.
Yeah.
But I hadn't finished what I'm going to put my jacket on.
Okay.
I hadn't finished really all the things I wanted to get done at that time, after 3 years, too. We were still, had potential for growth, and there were still things to be done. So.
What were some of those things that were still to be done?
Well, part of it was getting the office straightened out. The department office had been a disaster.
Oh.
For some years, and our administrative secretary was getting senile. And we had a real troublemaker in there, and it just didn't function.
Uh-huh.
So I spent a good bit of time trying to work that out, and I had some success there.
Uh-huh. While you are chair, are there personnel issues related to salary? That seems to come
always,
up in a lot of departments.
Always. I mean, space and salary were always the big issues. I think that's always true. I don't remember any specific major things about salary, but our department has a point system for the merit, where you get so many points for different things you do. It was instituted, I think, when I was an assistant professor. I didn't have anything to do with it. And we've had that, I don't know, 30 years now, probably, mm-hmm. 20, 28. And nobody likes it completely. Somebody's always complaining about it for some reason or another. I'm complaining about it right now. But so there's always been an issue, but the salary thing didn't really blow up until the department review, I think. So I don't remember major salary issues.
Okay. And this is a time when the university has some money to pass out for salaries?
Yeah, I think so. I think raises were pretty good in that period. I don't remember.
Uh-huh. Who else is active in the department at this time?
Well, Gary Feynman had come by that point, or was hired in that period, I guess. And Gary was real busy. I hired Karen Stryer toward the end of the period, and she was busy in the department. It's hard to remember who was here and who was added and so forth. Bob Miller had been chair prior to my term, and he was always a big help. He wasn't real active, but he was a good counsel,
mm-hmm.
in the department. And Margaret Schoeninger was hired, I think, right before I left.
Or maybe
the year before. No, but in addition to the biological section. And she was very active in many ways. That's the key to a lot of what we're going to be talking about.
Okay.
And I bullied the faculty, some of the faculty in biological anthropology, to hire her. They wanted somebody else, and I wanted her, and I pushed very hard for her and got her. And so there was a lot of resentment there as well. There's nothing that pops out, but this is also a long time ago. So,
Doug, you said at the beginning of this section that the department was not as productive as it could have been, and you tried to push productivity. How do you do that with tenured faculty?
Yeah, well, sometimes you just can't. And I think sometimes I tended to kind of ignore people who weren't doing a lot. I didn't give them resources and things like that. Not obviously. I mean, I didn't say, well, you didn't do anything last year, so you can't have a new computer. But I think generally, I don't know how you do it. I mean, we have this 5-year post-tenure review process now, and that's largely BS because nobody wants to say anything negative about anyone.
Uh-huh.
But it's tough. It's really tough. And we had a number of people like that.
Uh-huh. So your last year is 1989
as chair. Yep.
Is that a good ending or a bad ending to your
period? I think I'd probably been there a year too long at that point. And I had irritated several people. The laboratory where my chemistry lab was a biological anthropology laboratory that was not used. It was completely not used at all, just sitting there, since I had come to the department. But Ken Bennett, a biological anthropologist, thought it was his, even though it was never used. And I should have taken it to the department and said I would like to have this laboratory for my chemistry lab, and I didn't. I just sort of took it because I knew he if he said anything, the department would back me. And that was a huge mistake. That was a big mistake. I should have gone through the democratic process.
Uh-huh. And you didn't because you're decisive, right?
Well, I don't know. I didn't, maybe because I could do it at the time, and I didn't want to go through the BS in the department meeting that would involve. And I probably did it because I didn't have a lot of respect for him either, because he didn't do anything. And that's also not the right way to do things, so I shouldn't have done it.
Okay. But you set up your lab in 1989?
Yeah, I think 88 maybe, I can't remember, right in that period we took that space.
And that's funded by a major grant from NSF?
A series of them, yeah.
A series of them. Okay. So then the question is, what happens next in the saga of the department?
Well, I went away on sabbatical, and Jim Burton, my colleague, started telling me that Margaret Schoeninger was saying a lot of bad things about me around the department while I was still away. And I was really surprised to hear that. I had no idea where that was coming from or what it was about.
And this is the woman that you had pushed to hire?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I still, to this day, don't know what set her off. I really don't.
Hmm.
But anyway, she started a campaign against me. And I don't know exactly how it evolved. But we had a graduate student at that time called Michael Marchbanks, who had come probably in 88. From Texas, and he was doing some new work in archaeological chemistry that was really exciting, and he was doing stuff nobody else I knew was doing. So I worked very hard for that kid, and I got him money as an RA, and I got his quals exam waived so he didn't have to take exams so he could get through the program faster. We waived two or three students over the years at that point in time. Big mistake. And I don't know, the second year he was in the lab, maybe Burton realized that he didn't really seem to know what he was doing, and he was not around in the lab. And Burton had a couple of screaming fits because Burton was telling me he'd got to come in and do something, and he wouldn't do it. And at some point, Burton told me that he didn't think this guy could do what he was claiming. And so we said, Mike, you got to do some blind. You're going to do some blind tests. What he was doing was looking at organic residues in pieces of pottery with a mass spectrometer, and saying this pot contained blood, or this pot contained corn, or this pot contained something else, and nobody else had been able to do that.
Huh.
And so we said, well, we can prove to the world what you're doing here. We'll take some potsherds and we'll soak them in something and give them to you, and then you tell us what it is. Okay? And he refused to do that. So we were at the point of getting rid of him, basically. He also was going at that time over to chemistry, where Margaret Schoeninger had her laboratory. Even though she was in anthropology, she had an instrument in the chemistry building. And Isabel Treichel, who was the wife of the chair of chemistry, this comes into play later, was her lab person, ran the lab for Schoeninger. And I think she had maybe a student lunch or a lab group that got together. Marchbanks started going over there. Somehow, I assume Schoeninger bad-mouthing me and Marchbanks under pressure got the two of them together, and he started telling her that we had stolen his work, that we had copied his stuff and submitted it as an NSF proposal, and had treated him very, very badly. Okay?
Oh, my.
Yeah. So she started building up this campaign at that point, okay? Now, the first that I really knew something was going on, I was called over to Crawford, Dean Crawford's office. I think it was Crawford.
Don Crawford Don from Crawford. Philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. Who I liked a lot, had a good relationship with. And he and Judy and somebody else sat me down at a table and said, "We've had some complaints from graduate students about you, and you're going to have to shape up." They didn't tell me what the complaints were. They didn't tell me who it was. Fair enough, I guess. Just very generic message, okay? So I left that meeting just in complete shock. Now, that's not to say I hadn't pushed some graduate students hard in some cases and probably bullied some graduate students, some too. I'm not innocent in this matter, but I'm also not nearly as guilty as described, I would put it that way. And so I was just absolutely blown away, and I really had no idea what it was about. I really didn't have any sense of it at all. So I, went around for some time worrying about that, and then I started hearing that Schoninger was preparing a case against me. Okay? So Schoninger...
To take to the dean?
To take to the... I think she took it to the chancellor. I can't remember. I think it went to the chancellor. There may have been another meeting with the dean in there. I don't remember for sure. But if it did, I still didn't have... I was never told what was going on. Because I remember, it wasn't until... And this was about a year or maybe a year and a half later. This thing went on much too long. Maybe a year and a half later. Maybe 90. I don't remember. I got a document from the chancellor's office. I think it was the chancellor. Listing the charges against me. Now, none of this I'd ever heard before. Okay? I hadn't heard the details before. And Schoninger had collected a whole series of graduate student complaints about me, some faculty complaints. She'd gotten 6 faculty members to sign this document. There were 2 sets of charges. One was sort of misbehavior in the department and treating people badly and stuff. And the other was this plagiarism of this major work of Marchbanks that was sent in as an NSF grant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, I'll deal with that one first. Okay, the NSF grant was to get a position for Marchbanks. That's all it was for. And Marchbanks worked with us to write that proposal. I wrote the proposal, but he gave us his data to put in there to say, this is what he's going to work on, this is what he's going to do, and this is what we need the money for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he was fully involved. Now, Jim Burton can verify any of this stuff because he was too. So that was what I was accused of. And I had to deal with the university appointed committee, and defend myself there. Burton was called in to testify. I'm sure a lot of other people were too. Fitzpatrick.
Marianne Fitzpatrick
chaired that committee. And it was, I don't know, 5 or 6 faculty members. I was shaking. It was just awful, absolutely horrible. So I had to go in there and say, well, we wrote this proposal together. It was only for him. There wasn't anything else in it. It was just for him, and we're trying to get some money for him to keep working in the laboratory. They said, well, you didn't do anything really bad there, although they said, well, you should always cite the person who provided the data and stuff.
Did you have a lawyer?
That was the biggest mistake that I made, was not hiring a lawyer. I thought the university would be fair and take care of me. And that was a huge, huge mistake. Pure and simple.
This university committee, was it the university committee or was it an ad hoc committee?
No, it was an ad hoc committee. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, maybe there had been some kind of grievance committee or something. I don't remember.
Now, and you're not able to have any off-the-record conversations with the members of that committee?
Not now or then?
Then.
No, not that I knew of.
Uh-huh.
Now, I did see Marianne Fitzpatrick afterward, and she was a supporter and got me through that, I think. And I think she realized what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all this whole package of charges made me look like Satan, And I'd been overbearing and bullying, but I wasn't Satan. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, what I've learned is that Marchbanks, and this sounds wrong, but it's not. He's a pathological liar. There is a history of this. Okay? I thought this university would find out. Marchbanks told Schoninger, this is a little complicated, but that we were getting free analyses done in chemistry on their instruments there, and then that we were charging people for doing it. Okay? And Paul Treichel came after me for that, okay, and wrote some very nasty things. And what I said was, okay, why don't you call the person who was charged for these analyses and find out where that came from? Marchbanks was doing that. It wasn't us at all. And I knew that if they would check, they could at least see he was lying about something. They never fucking checked. They never fucking checked. I'm sorry. they didn't verify much of anything as far as I can tell. So I was left there pretty much hanging. Now I don't know this for sure, okay? But if they had checked this, they would have found out, because I know the guy who was getting charged. Okay? And he would have told them. And I just assumed, well, they're gonna check all this. I was so naive at that time. I mean, unbelievably naive.
Yes, because you'd been here
10, 12, 15 years.
Yeah. 15 years. Yeah. It's interesting, well, aside from the tragedy of it, it's interesting what you say about the university treating charges as fact.
Yeah, exactly. I was guilty as charged, pure and simple. I was never considered innocent in this matter. I was never told the charges until I got that letter. That was a year and a half into it. So I was just left hanging, not knowing what the hell was going on. And you know what? Some of the charges in the letter of my misbehavior in the department were that students in the field with me had a house that wasn't as nice as mine, and when we were walking fields out in the open country, I would whistle at them to get them to turn and walk another way.
That's a charge.
I swear to God. Okay. There was another charge that I told that I recognized a young woman's perfume and told her what it was. And I touched her shoulder one time. That's true. That was the only sexually oriented charge that was in there. I was told that I made a student cry in class. Okay? And that's true. This was a woman who was in my seminar, my graduate seminar, and for the third time had not done any preparation whatsoever. So I said, you know, you're going to have to be prepared next time or don't come. And she started crying. Okay? Mm-hmm. So... There were some other things that were bad. Okay, there was the stealing that laboratory basically, and what else was I charged with? I used to flip the bird at Schoninger when nobody else was looking. And somebody saw that one time. She was behind all of this, and she got Henry Bunn down the hall now to join her on this. Henry is some kind of zealot on faculty in archaeology. He is attacked. All of the senior members of the department at one time or another. I was the first. And I saw he cut out a piece from the University of Illinois where some faculty member had been sacked for something or other and wrote on it, this was what should happen to Price, and included in the package of things that that were there. So he's never been one of my favorite people since then.
Yes.
The other four people who signed that document didn't have any idea what was going on. Honestly had no idea what was going on. One of them was Herb Harvey, who was losing his mind at the time, I guess you could say. It was shortly before he retired. One of them was Walter Leutenegger, who was fired from the department for alcoholism, but who since apologized to me. One of them was Amico Nuki Tierney, who is now a friend and has apologized profusely for being involved in that at all. The other was Ken Bennett, whose laboratory I stole.
There's always shades of gray, isn't there?
And there's always stories on both sides. I mean, two sides of a story. But I have never, the plagiarism thing, that part of it was evaluated by the university, but never checked, as far as I know. Okay, although I don't know how far they about. I think all they did was interview people and decide who was telling the truth. And they certainly didn't check on Marchbanks. The other complaints, all the other stuff, I have never, ever been allowed to tell my story about or asked to tell my story about.
Really?
Yep.
Let's conclude side one of tape three.
Part.
problems. This is side two of tape three. So that the committee, the ad hoc committee chaired by Marianne Fitzpatrick, cleared you of stealing March Banks' data.
They set up a form we should fill out when we got data from people and about how we should publish it, and they said we should always be sure and cite the source of data in our publications, but they said that there were no charges that evolved from that.
And do you get an official apology from the university?
No.
For having gone through that?
No. I eventually got a letter from David Ward, which was pretty formal and legalistic, and at the end said the university, this will never be brought up again in the university, something to that effect. But not an apology, no.
Who else was on that review committee, do you remember?
I think Wang from geology. I really don't remember who else was on there. I remember Marianne Fitzpatrick and Wang, and there were three or four other members.
And you had one appearance or repeated appearances before that?
I remember one very clearly. I might have gone back. I can't remember for sure.
Yeah. Interesting to think that you should have had a lawyer.
I still think about it. Almost every time I walk across from the parking lot to here, sometime on that walk, I think about what happened. Because it was staggering. And every time I think, God, I should have had a lawyer, you know?
Yeah.
And I should have been told by the university that I could have a lawyer.
Doug, I'm surprised at that initial meeting with Don Crawford and Jimmy Craig, that you were sent out bereft with no information.
Well, I think the idea was they didn't want to reveal who the students were, and they didn't want to get into the charges. They were trying to protect the students, that's where it was. And I asked, you know, what have I done? And I was told only generically, you know, the students are complaining about your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you know, it was like being told, well, you're a really bad person.
Yes.
Get better.
This must have been, this is gratuitous to say, a very low point, almost disabling.
Yeah,
I would suspect.
It was very, very hard. And then it just kept going and getting worse. This was two and a half, three years of one thing after another generated by Schellinger, ultimately causing these problems. I don't know that she sent those graduate students in the first time to Crawford or not. But I'm pretty sure that complaint was from March Banks and then some students who were supporting him, and two or three, I guess, I don't know. But if she didn't send them, they grew out of her stirring up trouble about me.
Mm-hmm. So what happens next? I mean, the problems in anthropology, I remember, appeared in the newspaper.
Right. Well, there was three years later, there was a review of the department. And by that time, I think Schoeninger she was a very decisive force in the department and got people stirred up. We also, again, it's hard to remember the chronology of this. We had had two faculty members, I think in the time after my chair, or I know it's in the time after my chair, turned down for tenure. And then they were forced through by the university for various reasons, which I also, and they were very angry. Okay?
At you?
No. I was no longer chair.
Right.
This was after me. Maybe it was Frank Solomon was chair. Let's see. And I think Don Thompson was chair for a year in there, too. It may have been 3 or 4 years before the review came. But anyway, these two women had not done much and didn't deserve tenure. And one of them got a lawyer and scared the university, I think. And the other one brought her mother to our faculty meeting.
Really?
Yep. And I don't know if she filed suit or whatever happened, but we were told we should keep her in the department. One of those women works in Africa, and she got, I think, again, this is reconstruction, she got to the chair of the review committee, who is the oral history person on Africa in the history department, whose name I can't think of right now. He's famous on campus for African storyteller.
Oh, Harold Schoid.
Harold Schoid. Okay. And she, I think she convinced him that this was a poison pit in anthropology. And so we started hearing that this review was going to be really negative. Now, there were some unhappy people. I was still so pissed at Schoninger, I, you know, couldn't talk. And Bunn. There were these other tenure cases that had shredded things, and another guy, Rob Brightman, had been released, so my colleague next door here, who was his, this gets pretty personal, who had a good relationship with Brightman, was very angry that Amoco had been involved in Brightman's release, non-tenure. So there was a lot of different things going on, a lot of anger. But the department was functioning, and had a number of good people, I would say. I don't know. It was getting better. And I think there was some hangover from my, you know, dominating behavior, too. So anyway, the review committee wrote this devastating review recommending us for receivership and just listing one after another the problems in the department and the problems with the graduate students, which I still don't really fathom. And I think that, again, is a few faculty members telling the graduate students that, yes, things are really bad here and we need to change it. Okay?
Is Schoenberg, what's her name?
Schoninger.
Schoninger still in the department?
No,
at
she
this
left
point?
About 10 years ago and went to San Diego.
No, but was she here during the review?
Yeah, I think. Or maybe left. Yeah, I think she was. Mm-hmm. I think she was. Yeah, she would have. She was here 5 or 6 years. Yeah, so she would have stuck with me. So we got this review that was just devastating, and we had to go to talk to the graduate school about how we had too many graduate students, which was nonsense, and all the problems and how we were going to fix all this stuff, and we had to restructure the department, and we had to go to the dean, and we had to have a chair inserted. Karen Stryer was made chair, even though she was a pretty new associate professor, and she was pushed to full professor by the dean from a 2-year assistant professorship or 3-year assistant, 3-year associate professorship.
The dean being Phil Certain in
this
case?
This was right when Phil Certain. Now, wait a minute. No, there were the interim deans then.
There was Crawford.
Yeah.
Cronin retired.
Crawford Young. Yeah, was in.
Or no, Don Crawford.
But Don was only there a couple years, and he went to Santa Barbara.
And then Crawford Young.
Crawford Young was interim, I think.
For a year.
Yeah.
And then Phil Certain came in after Crawford.
So part of it, I think it was before Certain came in, because I think he came in when we did that push for the
archaeology
thing. So maybe it was Crawford Young was in there. I don't remember exactly. So, you know, we just took all kinds of heat. We're scared to death they're going to put us in receivers. It was bad enough. And then I'm 90% sure that this woman, African anthropologist, sent out facts to every major university department around the country, the information about the problems that we were having.
Oh. That's dishonorable.
Yeah, exactly. So somebody did, put it that way. And so the reputation of the department just went down the toilet, you know. These things they're cyclical and they're not killer, but they're bad, okay. So we still suffer from that quite a bit. And as far as I'm concerned, it was an enormous overreaction. Now, there were some problems in the department, but things were not as bad as they were reported in that document. And I think that's because the document was biased by the three or four very unhappy people in the department. And you shouldn't have unhappy people in the department, but these were at least two people who we didn't want here. That's how I interpret that very bad review we got.
And so the African anthropologist would have had presumably a good relationship with Schoid, yeah, since they both worked in African studies.
That's my assumption, yeah. And again, I don't know this.
Yeah, I understand. It's
my reconstruction. Yeah.
And who is the African anthropologist?
Sharon Hutchinson.
Okay. Is she still in the department?
Yes. We were not allowed to get rid of her. And we tried. We tried to get her, after she was forced to tenure on here, we tried to get her in other departments. I didn't, but the Stryer did. And we were completely unsuccessful. I think it was Stryer.
Mm-hmm. So the department goes into receivership?
No. We had an appointed chair from our own numbers, and we were just given all this list of things. And we had a review committee, which watched over us for at least a year, maybe 2 years. And we would meet with them and tell them what we were doing to fix things and so forth.
Hmm. And Karen Stryer is chair?
Yeah.
And is there a formal review committee that's set up? You were saying that met with
yes,
the department?
Yes, there was, because the review committee that wrote the document was not the same committee that the oversight committee, whatever we call it.
Yeah, and who was on the oversight committee?
It was a lot of people. It was seven, eight people, but Jim Knox in geography was the chair of it. Dana Carvey, Dana somebody from geology, Dana Geary from geology was on it. Marianne might have been involved in that in some way. I'm sure there's a list somewhere, but I can't. There were 8 or 10 of them, but I can't remember.
And did that work well, or?
I resented it myself. We certainly restructured some of the bylaws and the organization of the department, and put in more oversight over the graduate students and how they were treated and so forth. And we tried to reduce graduate student numbers, which again I think was a huge mistake. This department, like departments all over the country, runs in different ways internally. I talked about the three divisions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you can't generalize across those three divisions. It simply doesn't work. And that was how things were normally done in that review and recommendation. So it wasn't always meaningful or useful.
And Doug, how, on a personal level, how do you do during the decade of the 90s? I mean, all this is happening 90 through 93, 94,
yeah,
I gather.
Yeah.
How do you cope, and where are you today?
it was really hard. I mean, there was a period when I worried about my job and my family and my career and mm-hmm. and my future for too much too long.
Mm-hmm.
It took a long time again, and that was really bad. And then there were, you know, there's a lot of resentment floating around, not just me but other people, and a lot of strained relationships in those years. It got better over time. I'm losing my care for the department, but I still care about the department,
uh-huh.
and I would still like to see this be a better department. But that's a tough thing to do to achieve that. I have lots of thoughts and ideas about if I could run this place,
yes.
what it would be like. But I'm more interested in my own research now. And
you were saying that yesterday, that's what you were focused on.
Yeah.
Once word about the difficulties got out, did you get a fair amount of support from colleagues around the country? Or did they avoid talking about it?
I don't think it was brought up. I mean, somebody at a meeting might say, what's going on there? You know, we hear you guys are having this bad review.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't at an individual level. I don't know that support, I mean, I don't think people knew exactly what had happened to me in the charges that were brought up. I don't remember anything specific along those lines.
Doug, we were just talking off tape. Would you summarize what is your essential observation about this, the role of the university in all of this, understanding that it's a human institution and bad things will happen? The question is how the university responds.
Yeah. Well, my sense was I expected the university to be fair and to take care of me through this, and to assume I didn't do it. And it was really the opposite. I think I was assumed to be guilty, I was not treated fairly in any way, and it was a devastating process.
Mm-hmm. Doug, you said that some of the faculty who signed the initial complaint have since apologized.
Yeah.
Was that helpful or not, or didn't matter?
No, it helped a lot. It helped a lot that those two people mentioned that to me. And again, they said, well, they just had no idea what was going on, and they just sort of joined this group of people. Margaret Challenger, very charming person, and very persuasive. So.
And you had known this Margaret, I take it.
Yeah, I'd known her for a few years before she came here, and she was doing research similar to mine. And that's one of the reasons I wanted her here. I thought we'd have a terrific team to do this stuff. And she got here, and I had a whole bunch of samples to give to her on a fabulous project. And she said, oh, I don't want to do that. So right away, I had a sense that this wasn't going to be the team I had hoped for.
I see. Is there a case of professional jealousy involved here?
From me? No.
No, from her.
I don't. She came from Harvard. She'd been at Johns Hopkins.
Oh.
She was well respected in the field. She came as an associate professor, I think. I don't know exactly what was going on. I have some thoughts, but they're totally unfounded. So.
Uh-huh. Doug, from the point of the review to today, what has happened in the department?
Well, I think the review and the bitterness that was around at that point have passed. Some of the players have left or retired, and that's helped a great deal. The resentment and anger has died down among various people, for sure. I think there is a pretty good sense of consensus in the department now on most matters. There's still issues, of course. And there's still a lot of room for change. This could be a really good department with some vision and some direction. But on the other hand, it's no longer a collegial place to be. Most of my colleagues are never here. You walk around this department, most of the doors are closed, and that's not because somebody's hiding inside, it's because nobody's in there. People work at home, or they work around the country, and they're not here. If you come into this department most days, you can find me, you can find Jim Burton, maybe Yang Shun, our Chinese colleague down the hall, maybe one or two other people, and the office staff. There are 23 people in this department. Karen Stryer might be in part of the time, and that's it. So there's not an opportunity for collegiality in some ways. And I that's really bad for students. It's really bad for collegial relationships. It's bad for interaction. It sucks. And it doesn't make me want to stay around.
Is that pattern reversible, or is that the way it's going to be?
I think it could be reversed. I think if you made this a place people where they understood what being here meant, and if there was a little more attention to students and people aware that their students wanted to talk to them once in a while. Even when my colleagues are here, many of them close their damn doors. So the students don't know whether they're there or not, you know? I sit in here with my door open all the time, and I'm here all the time, and my students can come in any time, okay? So I think you could do it with some work on attitude changes and some, you know, conversations about why this kind of stuff is important. But whether you can really change it or not, I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. I hear this observation a lot.
Yeah.
I hear it in English. I hear it in history. Those are the most. That nobody's there.
Yeah.
That 20 or 30 years ago, there was actually exciting intellectual work going on in the halls.
Yeah.
When one professor would talk to another over 10 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I am so lucky that I have Jim Burton, because he and I can talk about a lot of the stuff we do. And we do all the time. He bugs me all the time.
to be frank about it. Huh?
So that is really important, and that keeps us doing a lot of things. And if my colleagues were really productive and stayed home and got stuff done, I'd say, okay, I can live with that. But we're talking about people who don't do anything or do very, very little. And still are not here to be around for students. You know, it's peeves.
Yes, but I think it's an important observation relative to the evolution or devolution of the university.
Absolutely. And people being away that much, they're not going to feel the loyalty or affection for this place either in the longer term. So you're losing a lot.
In terms of what's the strongest division of the department now?
Well, we still have the sectional divisions. I don't know. The merit system still irritates different people at different times. There's some... I don't know. I'm not sure there's a major one.
Interesting. But I think we did talk yesterday that the student level of interest in anthropology is still high. That you're...
Yes, on a general national level, yes.
And here...
undergraduate courses, yep. In archaeology.
In archaeology.
I mean, the ethnic studies course taught by cultural anthropology is huge, but it's required. And if it wasn't required, I'm not sure there would be very much interest. It's hard to say. I mean, our general anthropology course still fills up. So.
Interesting.
But that might be ethnic studies, too. I don't know.
Doug, let me ask you then, before we move to university service, and particularly in view of the turbulent 90s, if you have some observations about the quality and the effectiveness of various of the university leadership, both in Bascom and in Letters and Science.
My views are not very good.
They're
pretty negative. And I don't know how much I really want to go into this, quite frankly.
Okay.
But... I thought that Cronin was a pretty good dean. I really did. I thought he did a very fine job in many ways. And the earlier chancellors of the university, Ed Young and so forth, they were really respectable, visionary people in some ways, I think. Donna Shalala was an interesting addition to this university. And she did some very good things. You know, I think she's gave a spark to things and got stuff moving that had been stagnant for a while. She also did some things that I just don't care for. She took credit for a lot of stuff that she wasn't really involved in. And I always thought that was kind of cheap, but maybe that's how important people work. I don't know. Our more recent chancellors, David Ward, he tried to make some changes, but he instituted what I think has been a terrible program of cluster hiring, which has taken 150 positions from departments to bring in people doing pretty specialized things and without obviously an academic home. And a lot of those positions have ended up in the humanities. That's good because they were competing with resources of the biological sciences and harder sciences so much now. But it took away from programs like ours. We've been waiting 6 years for a replacement position for an archaeologist. Okay? Now, in my opinion, this cluster hiring was started because critical research happens in the cracks, in the interfaces. Okay? We have known that and done that for many, many years before David Ward discovered it. Okay? I've always worked at the cracks with other people, and that everybody knows that, and lots of people do that. So I think that program has seriously hurt departments. Now, I don't want to get into arguments about how long departments are going to last and how bigger changes in academic things, but I think cluster hiring should have another name, which I cannot repeat it. Okay? And for that, I think David Ward did a generally good job, but I blame him for that. And I think that really brought things down a lot, in my opinion. John Wiley gave my name to the newspapers during the review of the department, and I will never forgive him for that. He told the reporter my name as one of the principal figures in the problems in the Department of Anthropology in the Cairden State Journal.
Really?
Yeah. He said, I did it accidentally. Didn't know it was a reporter. So my opinion of him is biased, but I do not think he is a dynamic or visionary chancellor in any sense of the word. I think the university has gone downhill substantially in the last 15 years, in part for funding, certainly, but in part for a lack of vision. I think Phil Certain was not a good dean. He treated me very badly. I went over to his office one time when he first became dean, and maybe I wasn't talking to Schoeninger or something. Okay, he called me over to his office, and I asked him. I said, "Well, what do you want me to come over there for? Because I've been through all this crap." And I was thinking then, well, maybe I should get a lawyer, you know. And he said, "Oh, I just want to talk to you about some stuff in the department." And I got over there, and he read me my rights about how he can give with one hand and take away with the other hand unless I shape up. Okay? It really threatened me.
Really?
Yes. And then he did this dead baby talk when we went for the thing. So I have absolutely no respect for that man. I think he was in three times longer than he should have been, and I am very glad he's out.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. What about the current dean?
I like Gary a lot, and I'm assuming he's doing a good job. He's pretty invisible, and that brings out maybe my biggest issue about this university and its relationship with its faculty. The university essentially ignores the faculty. Okay, now this doesn't include the graduate school, which I regard as the saving grace of this university. But the administration, if I was a dean, the first thing I would do would be to write the faculty and tell them how much I appreciated, how much I would hope to improve their situation, and how I would be certainly willing to talk to them. We have never heard from a dean. Deans don't contact the faculty unless it's to tell us they're in election or to give to United Way or something along those lines. Okay? So, I mean, you always feel like you're kind of just, you know, a servant over here. Now, I'm treated very well in terms of money and nice office and lots of other things. But I think the administration makes, and the dean is the one really at the point of the sword here, who needs to make the faculty feel like they're cared for and involved. Mm-hmm. I really think that would be so, so important. And I think the morale here, I think the quality of the university would improve from that alone. And I've never understood why there wasn't something more along those lines. It's astounding to me. It seems to me the first thing you'd want to do is, because the university is about the faculty and the students, it's not about the goddamn administration, you know?
Correct.
You got me going here, but you know how our parking rates have gone up here terribly over the years, and parking is always an issue. Now, the number of faculty has decreased over the last 20 years, by 100 positions or something. The number of students 20 years ago was 45,000, that's 41,000. So there's not more students and there's not more faculty. Who's taking all those parking positions? The administration, I haven't looked this up, but I'll bet you it's quadrupled in the last 25 years. And some of that I realize is necessary with government regulations and bureaucracy and stuff. But the administration of this university and maybe others is much too big, quite frankly.
And is it?
I think it is. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's costing us a lot. I don't know all the details, okay? So I don't know if all those positions are really necessary to respond, so I can't say. The other issue we didn't have really talk about is governance,
as
I remember.
Yeah, and if you want to go into that now, that's good, because
you shouldn't let me get off on parking, because then I'll start talking about how we had to pay for the football team when they were in the red.
Include side two of tape three. This is tape four, side one, Professor Doug Price. Doug, you were talking at the end of the last tape about the relationship between the dean and the faculty, and that was beginning to move into your evaluation of where faculty governance stands now.
Right, right. I think faculty governance has eroded dramatically. And I think the administration is making most decisions now about curriculum, about the direction of the university, about most of the things that the faculty used to decide. The cluster hiring would be an example of that was imposed from above. The ethnic studies requirements make a lot of courses have to be created. My sense is that the faculty really is only a rubber stamp for most things anymore.
When did that change?
I I don't know. I think it's been gradual. I think you could, if you could graph such things, it would probably be as the number of administrators grow, the faculty governance decreases. You can't measure such things, but that's part of my sense that the administration is just making all kinds of decisions now. Now that's not everything. I mean, they tried to move us down to the old computer science building. A year ago, or to get us to agree to do that in the future, and we fought it and actually won. Probably a mistake. We probably should have gone down there, but I'd hate to give up this office.
Doug, I wonder, in terms of faculty governance, is that still a viable concept for a place like this?
Well, it should be. In theory, I mean, this university should be about education and faculty and teaching and research and building knowledge. But universities have become multinational corporations, you know. I mean, this is not so much about faculty governance, but it's something that I think about, and maybe it's important to say, I don't know. I love college football. It's. I just can't wait for fall to come and to cheer Michigan I like Wisconsin, all other sports except football. I'm still locked into Michigan for football. But I mean, I love it. I live for that. It's the best time of year. And I think that college football now is a disaster. Mm-hmm. It's a business. They exploit people. The university lives to make money. They put up a statue of our coach down there. I mean, give me a break. They're spending millions and millions of dollars to run that program. And you've talked to the administration about, well, it helps get people to give money to the university. People give money to the athletic department. And those people, I think, would probably give some of that money to the university. People can be proud of an intramural team if they want to. People can be proud of a local team if they want to. It's wrong, but the university supports it, and I don't think they can get out of it. They're in a cycle of money making and reputation based on football. You have this term now. I see. I was a thing about an NSF panel last week, and I got a proposal from University of North Texas, and they call themselves an emerging research university. Okay, I never heard of this place before, right? So emerging research. So all they need is a good football team, and they're gonna be thought of as one of the best universities in the country, you know? It's wrong. It's completely wrong. And coaches getting paid, oh boy, this is not about faculty governance, but you tell me why a coach should be paid $2 million. I'd love to hear that.
You're asking the wrong person.
I think that faculty governance is important. It's hard to do. It's complicated. There's a lot of stuff that faculty wouldn't want to do in terms of decision-making at the university. But I think the faculty are going to become workers here rather than leaders.
Well, what I have heard from other faculty is, yes, the acknowledgement of the contentiousness and inefficiency of faculty governance, but that the reputation of this university was made during those decades when faculty governance was strong.
Yeah.
And I've had more than one faculty say that they believe the university is essentially coasting on its earlier decades.
I think that's a very reasonable statement. I mean, you see a number of universities getting better. North Carolina, even Arizona, California schools are getting stronger. And I don't know how you could say this place is getting better. So if we're not coasting, at least we're losing traction.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were in the Faculty Senate, I saw from your
years
CV
and years ago.
In 75, yeah. 77. Yeah. I realize that is 30 years ago.
Yeah.
What was it like then?
Well, I was we sort of banished junior faculty to be senators in this department because most people don't want to waste their time over there. When I was there, I just remember these long-winded speeches from Brock and some other people, Anatole Beck. And some of it was, you know, worthwhile. And there were some liberal points of view that were brought out there that were really important, I thought. But a lot of it was just wasted time, silly, trivial issues. I mean, I certainly think the University Senate and the University Committee could deal with weightier issues sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
And what is your perspective on
the relations between the university and the state legislature. And
I think the state legislators are morons. Well, that's what I think.
And how would you address that?
Well, I think profs was probably a very good strategy to take, the Profs Inc. organization. Mm-hmm. And I'm a member, I pay dues to that and so forth. That's a good way, and I don't know, if somehow you could get those guys to come on campus and walk around some and see what's going on. Most of those people are pretty uneducated as far as I can tell. I mean, I can't even remember the insane stuff they were proposing last year. It was just bananas. I don't know. I mean, maybe you work on their constituents rather than them, try and get somebody else elected, but that's a difficult job.
And perhaps this is a good time to ask you to speculate on the future of higher education, not just in Wisconsin, but in the country. Because Whoa. It does seem to be it's difficult these days.
Yeah, well, it's certainly different. Boy, I don't know. You have some models, like Arizona State University, where the university president is trying to change the structure of the academy, basically, mm-hmm. and reorganizing departments and programs into new, completely new kinds of arrangements in the hope that that's going to reflect the modern world and deal with relevance and modern issues in better, more effective ways. And I mean, certainly the sort of basic format of disciplines we have, it should be more flexible than it is. This is in part because I think archaeology should be a separate focus. But I mean, if you look at history, departments have changed. They split up into different disciplines and so forth. It's just part of the process. It's a very slow and conservative process at the university, but I think that will continue. I actually think that the university pays too much attention to the outside world. So we respond to affirmative action, we respond to kids with crappy educations in primary and secondary schools where they come here where they can't read or they can't count or they can't do percentages, as I said yesterday, and we make it our responsibility to train them out, to teach them basics. That's a huge use of resources in my mind, and I don't think that's the mission of the university, quite frankly. I think our mission is to train the best and the brightest. Unfortunately, I think that's all we can afford to do. And I think that research and education generally is a hierarchical process where you try and find the best and the brightest and give them the most you can. And hopefully they'll take our society higher. And the cost of that is that the less than best and brightest don't get that. Now, I remember Clinton saying toward the end of his presidency that everybody should go to college. And that's really stuck with me a long time. I don't think that's true. Mm-hmm. It's complex in our society, and certainly not having a college education is the what separates some of our classes right now in this country. But I think you have to maintain a focus on quality and a focus on mission, which is building knowledge and helping people, you know? And if we start doing all of these other things, to involve more students, to worry about a lot of other issues, then I think we lose that focus. And then universities become businesses, the money issue becomes another matter. It's not a rosy forecast, I would say, given the current trend of issues. Now, I also see this from a European perspective. I've been at the University of Aberdeen a few times, where there's a strong business model. A scary business model. And I spend some time at the universities in Denmark, which are still pretty traditional for the most part. I can imagine a scenario in which no faculty come into a department, that it's a virtual department, that all education is done online, and degrees are done online, and you know, people go to sports events. And that would be basically how a university operates. I think doing that, you lose the humanity of the process, and I hope that doesn't happen.
It's interesting. I saw a billboard on Regent Avenue. You've probably seen it too, for some school I'd never heard of. But you could get your
undergraduate. University of Phoenix, probably.
I've forgotten. you could get your degree online, in your undergraduate degree, in 3 years. Mm. I thought, 3 years? You can't do it in 3 years. You need 4 years.
Yeah.
Just to become educated.
Right, right. But they probably give you credit for a lot of other courses or life experiences. That's another good one.
Doug, you were saying yesterday that, you know, you were getting tired of teaching and that you really, you really want to move into full-time research, I take it.
Yep.
Is that what you, do you see yourself as a researcher for the next couple of decades primarily?
Yeah, hopefully.
Uh-huh.
Again, the major reason, there's two reasons to retire, and one of them is that, so that I'm not interrupted by teaching, basically. I do some committee work, and there's too many meetings in the department, but that's not overwhelming. But mm-hmm. the teaching is a constant interruption on a daily or several days a week basis. And in a way, that simply expresses the privileged position I have, because I'm supposed to teach. But I'm also doing some very, very interesting research. I have two huge grants I need to keep track of and work on most of the time. So it is an interruption. So that would be one reason to retire. The other reason, the personal reason, more about family and long-term stuff. I'm tired of teaching. It doesn't include graduate students, okay? That's a different kettle of fish, and I'd be happy to teach a graduate seminar or this research methods course I teach, the things I like to teach to graduate students.
Uh-huh. Are you at a point in your career when you could say to the department you only want to teach an occasional graduate seminar?
I could say that, but it wouldn't do anything. We have to teach two courses a semester unless we can get released somehow.
I see. So you're still under the gun to teach those two courses.
Yeah, still my job. Yeah. Job description.
Yeah. And do you anticipate continuing for a few years teaching? Or do you know yet?
I'm going to retire as soon as I can.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, coming this summer, every summer you're in the field.
Right.
Yeah.
In a wonderful place.
This concludes the oral history interview with the very accomplished and very distinguished Professor Doug Price. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you, and I enjoyed it very much.